First of all, I'd like to say it's fantastic to be here. It's an amazing location, and I'd like to congratulate Molly both with the chair and with a great symposium. So I'll be continuing in the vein of mutations and going from statistical models to biological mechanisms, which I'll do literally. So I'll talk about maybe half of my talk about statistics, and then I'll talk about biological discoveries made by statistics. And the interesting part is that in terms of mutations, there are two complementary ways to think about them and two complementary fields. So one is the amazing field of experimental DNA replication, DNA repair, mutagenesis field. And this is primarily driven by the work in experimental system, well controlled. You can manipulate the system. The issue is that you do not know whether it's relevant or not. So usually this is one locus in one non-human species where you can really understand what's going on, but you don't know the relevance of that. So the other type of analysis, I think pioneered by Michael Nachman here and continued by David Hausler and others, started with the appearance of genomic data initially in primates, where people started comparing primate genomes and making some inference about mutational process. And here you actually know that this is happening in humans or apes, and this is happening at the genome scale, but you have no idea what's going on, right? So what's the underlying biology of the process? So now, as I said, we have experimental work in experimental systems. We have increasing number of computational analysis of various data, starting with species divergence, going through population variation, through de novo germline data sets, somatic mutations, cancer mutations, and so forth. And the problem is that this characterizes patterns well, but is unable to explain the biology behind them. So I was pretty naive in the beginning. It's maybe we work in this field for about 10 years. Initially, I thought that, okay, so we'll learn statistical patterns, and I would go to a real meeting with real DNA repair, DNA mutagenesis experimental biologists, and I would show them the patterns, and they would tell me what's going on. And the reality is, unfortunately, you go to this meeting, and they're amazing scientists, and there are maybe 300 people, and everybody has his or her favorite mutational process, and you show them the pattern, and every single person says, this is my process, and you end up with nothing. So this has been the story of our life in the field. So we're trying to come up with statistical methods that generate biology hypotheses. And by the way, I started my first experimental postdoc in the lab. Hopefully we can validate more of them. Okay, so success story mentioned by Kelly Harris in her talk comes from cancer work by Mike Stratton and Ludmila Alexandrov and others. And they came up with the following model. They said, okay, so I have a spectrum, meaning that I have type of mutations, and I know what's important are flanking nucleotides, and we'll say triplet. Again, we mentioned already pentamers and sevenmers, but let's say base to 3' and base to 5'. And this comes to 96 mutational types, and we can think about the spectra. And we can think about exposures. So the idea in cancer genomics that there are various mutagens, exogenous or endogenous, and different samples, different tumors, are exposed at different levels. So this gives you a statistical instrument. So the idea here is that there would be, for example, UV or smoking, or again, upper back, or various pol epsilon mutations and so forth. And you can learn this type of representation, so intensity of each mutation associated with each mutagen when exposure differs between the samples. So again, this is the cartoon. I can come up with a bunch of spectra. I can say that I have different signatures in this form. I can learn the model, assuming that exposure to all these processes, exposures are different between my samples. And this comes back to the matrix factorization problem, right? So I'm saying, okay, I have a whole bunch of each process has certain intensity for each trinucleotide or mutation type out of 96. I know that each sample has a differential intensity of the process, different differential exposure. And if I multiply one by another, I observe my data, which is number of mutations in of each type per sample. And they proposed to work with non-negative metric factorization to resolve that, which would not work for what I'm going to talk about, so we need different machinery. But that's the basic idea in cancer genomics. So the problem in germline is that exposures are very similar among individuals, even though Kelly just told us that comparing primates and comparing different human populations gives you some mileage, but it's very different from cancer, right? Everybody's primarily exposed to the same thing. And spectra are also very similar. Again, we saw amazing stories about how important differences are, but generally these are very similar spectra. So we just cannot use this approach. What we decided to do, we decided to move to spatial models and exploit variability of mutation rate along the genome. So the idea here is that we observe mutations along the genome, and we postulate that they are driven by a whole bunch of mutational processes. And again, each process is characterized by mutational spectrum, right? So so you go along the genome, and at each point in the genome, you see superposition of independent processes. So far, know nothing, I just postulate the model that I have variable processes, they act completely independently. Each has a signature, and what we're seeing along the genome is superposition. So the framework is this. If I'm thinking about one mutational type, say would be A to G or C to T, I have a hypothetical process one, I have no idea what it means. I have a hypothetical process two, I go through genomic positions, and I see this superposition, right? So we simulated this with assuming Gaussian processes going along the genome and superpositions and trying to develop pretty complicated inference models. Turns out that based on the simulation, very simple idea works. So what we're doing is we cut up the genome by windows. So this means that I assume that every process has differential intensity at each window. Okay, so every process characterized by mutational types, and its intensity along the genome varies. This means that I can take, for each process, this row, right, which would be intensity at each genomic window. And of course, each process I can characterize by a column, how many mutations happen in each process, out of my mutational types, right? So again, I have columns, I have rows, I do this, and I can construct the matrix, again, process by mutation type, which is familiar. But now I can take all the information along the genome, it's a lot of windows, but I can still think about the matrix. I multiply these matrices, I observe my data, I'm back to matrix factorization problem. Now, there are a couple of mathematical details that I'm not going to cover because this is primarily work by Vova Siplarsky and Ruslan Soldatov. This is very tricky because non-negative matrix factorization doesn't work in this data. We found what works, and we found originally in simulations and then in data, it's independent component analysis. So basically, we require components being independent, not linearly independent, but it goes to higher moments. In reality, it's a two-step procedure. So again, I skip details, but I would be happy to discuss it with everyone who's interested. Now, when I'm saying it's ICA, it's not NMF, it means that we have to live with negative mutation rates. So we think about enrichment or depletion rather than how many mutations happen in this context. Right, so we'll have negative numbers. Okay, so now one more technical details before I will move into biology. And what we're exploiting, because downstream is symmetry between DNA strands. Because one problem with all these methods, I have no idea how many components I should select. Right, so how many relevant processes exist in the human genome, I don't know. But I can find out. The way I can find out, I'm thinking about symmetry of DNA between DNA strands, and we know DNA is a symmetric molecule. However, there are processes like transcription or replication that break the symmetry. So as soon as there is transcription, there is transcribed strand and non-transcribed strand. And as soon as I have replication, there is leading strand and lagging strand. So, and some types of double strand break repair also breaks symmetry of DNA. So it means that the process, mutational process, can be strand independent or can be strand dependent if it depends on direction of replication, direction of transcription, and other forces that are asymmetric. It would be an strand-dependent process. So this is how it looks. So because we have reference, we assume that, for example, I use transcription as an example. Genes are oriented randomly with respect to reference. If I cut up the genome into windows, half of them in transcribed regions, genes would be oriented one direction, half of them in the other direction. So then I throw mutations in. And what happens is the following. So if I have A to G here, so normally we don't know whether it's A to G or T to C. So this is why people use 96 contacts, because we have no idea. However, I know that if I have A to G versus reference, and this is a strand-dependent process, I'm likely to have A to G as well versus reference next to it. So we move from 96 to 192, right? So we use directionality. And when we use directionality, it means that for every process I'm going to learn as a component, there will be, if it's strand dependent, there will be another process that will be independently learned. And these two processes would have this feature of self-symmetry, of symmetry. So if I use reverse complement as a symmetry feature, this process would match each other exactly. So I know, like, this is how it would look like, right? So this is real data. I'm running a little bit ahead of myself. So if I have this type of situation, there are two processes, and with shades of color show complementary pairs. So it's 192. So you see, for each you have complementary pair, and this would be, so what I learn two components. So this is why the language is a little complicated. I use components or signature, what the methodology learns, and I use process, what I think is happening. So I think there is one process, because I see that there are two components and they are self-symmetric with respect to complementarity. And that's very powerful. We found this extremely powerful. So again, some mutation process strand independent, and if you're strand independent, you're self-complementary. And if you're strand dependent, you're not self-complementary, so correlation is almost zero if you look at loadings, but you always have another process that is complementary to you. So what happens is that now I can look at how many components I want to learn, and I know that the only components that are real are those that pass the test. We call it reflection test. Because there is no information about symmetry of DNA in the learning process, so it either works or it doesn't. So if it's either it's real or it's not real. Okay, I have to speed up and move to data. We cannot work directly with de novo data because we need a lot of mutations to train. So we approximate as many in the field. We take rare single nucleotide variants out of TopMed as training. We validate on another data set of polymorphism, and then we move to de novo mutation data to validate that this is the reality and we're not studying something in polymorphism that is not de novo mutation. Again, 192 types, that's critical. In simulations, we identified that we can go down to as short windows as 30 kb. Going to finer scale requires factorization of Poisson models, and that's very difficult. If anybody knows how to do it, I'm happy to talk to you. And again, we run independent component analysis and also do bootstrap and look at reflection test. Then what's kind of amazing is that we now know how many components we want, because if I go for 13 components that collapse to 9 processes, I have everybody's passing reflection test. So I either generate self-symmetric process, or I have another process in the data that is complementary symmetric. As soon as I go over 13, this breaks, everything else is rubbish. I have to say that trying to look at random matrix theory and finding the right number of components didn't work in our hands, right? So reflection test tells you how many processes are there. So we believe there are 9 processes in the game at this resolution. What are the processes? Now again, we didn't tell the procedure about symmetry of DNA, we didn't tell about epigenomic features, so now I can correlate it with epigenomic features. We find amazing set of correlations, and this is how I'm going to interpret them. And these are the processes, and some of them we can speculate about, and I'll try to speculate about something known and then something new. And there are some where we have no idea what's going on, even though correlations with epigenomic features are quite striking. So the first picture is replication timing mentioned by a couple previous speakers. So for example, component 13, which is also process 13 because it's self-symmetric. This is how it looks. And this is the its over-replication timing. So we first documented association of mutation rate with replication timing 10 years ago. And this is significant but weak association, and it wasn't clear whether this is truly timing or it's associated with something else which is correlated with timing. So now if you look at this specific process, the correlation is coefficient is 0.6. It's really strongly tracking replication timing. The other process that we previously worked on, and this goes nicely after Molly's talk, and Molly mentioned that we now believe that a lot of germline mutations are actually through DNA damage, and this is a very strong component. And we call it bulky damage for the following reason. So again, it splits. It splits into two components, right? So this is a strand-dependent process. And this is how it looks like relative to direction of genes. Right, so these are different genes that they are colored by direction. So there is one process that goes like this, one process going like this. Again, this is total magic because we never let the statistical procedure know that there are such things as genes. So it's very asymmetric with respect to direct of transcription. And this goes well with our previous story published a few months ago, where we directly looked at direction of transcription and replication with respect to trinucleotides. We found that asymmetry with respect to transcription also correlates with asymmetry with respect to direction of replication. And why we think this is signature of DNA damage, because the most known process associated with direction of transcription is so-called transcription-coupled repair. So this is the pathway of nucleotide excision repair. Usually you bring this helicase TF2H to the lesion, unwind DNA, excise DNA with damage, this strand with the damage, and there is the resynthesis and ligation step. So what's important, you can bring this system in two different ways to the damage. One is global repair, another one is called transcription couple. So if your RNA polymerase, you transcribe the gene, hit the bulky damage, cannot go forward. And what you do, you recruit the system, but you only recruit the transcribed strand, right? So you cannot recruit the non-transcribed strand. So this generates the asymmetry. Why in the world there should be association with replication direction for the same process? And this is our thinking. By the way, I skipped most of the story because I think we tested it on cancer data and also in direct experiments. So the story is that replication is asymmetric. So leading strand is primarily replicated by polymerase epsilon, lagging strand by delta. And in leading strand, it's continuous synthesis. In lagging strand, it's Akazaki fragments. So if I'm on the lagging strand, I'm pole delta, I replicate DNA, I hit bulky damage, I cannot go forward. What do? I just start the next fragment. I don't really care. So damage is very frequently bypassed. So this damage that Molly mentioned that is retained close to the end of the cell cycle, I have to go to the replication. On lagging strand, I just bypass it. On leading strand, however, it's continuous synthesis. If I'm polymerase epsilon, I hit the damage, I have to resolve it, I cannot go forward. It's occasionally bypassed on the leading strand as well, but much less frequently. So there is a fork collapse, and what we see, we don't think we see break-induced replication that was mentioned in the first talk of the meeting. But I think what we're seeing is that there are multiple pathways that are error-free, where you collapse the fork, call for repair, and this creates asymmetry with respect to replication. So basically, our hypothesis, again, shown in experiments and cancer data, is that the damage is symmetric with respect to DNA strand, but the resolution is asymmetric. So you repair on transcribed strand, you repair on the leading strand, you don't repair on non-transcribed or lagging. Okay, move to methylation. So mentioned in two talks today, so I can be pretty quick. So we have two components that are, again, same as processes because they are self-symmetric. One is associated with we believe by CPG deamination. So these are transitions within CPG context. Another one is transversions, and this is what was mentioned in Kelly Harris' talk. And that's interesting because what does it do and why is it arising here? And interestingly enough, if we look at correlation with epigenomic features, we see that as expected, the process of transitions is positively correlated with rate of methylation, with rate of methylation, and also positively correlated with rate of hydromethylation. However, if we look at the signature of the process leading to transversions, we still see positive correlation with hydromethylation, but sharp negative correlation with methylation. The process is primarily localized to CPG islands that are actively demethylated. And the model we're proposing, and it's related to what Kelly was saying, is that if you're methylated cytosine, of course, one way to mutate is a deamination, and this leads to T. But if you have active demethylation process in regulatory regions, then it's TET-induced, and weirdly enough, active demethylation goes through removal of cytosine. So you create a basic site. So you go through hydromethylation step, and then there is a basic site that normally is repaired back by base excision repair. But what we know is happening with a basic site if base excision repair doesn't work, for example, you don't have immediate access to the other strand, you usually create G because of translesion polymerase. For example, Rev1 always sticks G into a basic site. So this creates the way for this signature to arise. And again, it's a small fraction of the genome, but that's a very important one. That's a regulatory, these are regulatory sequences that are prone to this mutational mechanism. Okay, so now I'm going to follow up on age of mothers and DNA damage in oocytes. And I'm talking about process 4/5, and because I call it 4/5 means two components, you immediately know it's trend-dependent, which is not what we expected. And why we think it's oocyte-specific, because again, if we look at de novo data, we observe mutations in children, and in some regions we can phase and we can find out whether mutations are maternal origin or paternal origin. And about 4 years ago, we observed the C2G clusters in the genome. And then a number of groups, including Johnson et al., they pointed out that these clusters are of primarily maternal origin. And they found a few regions in the genome where these clusters, de novo clusters of maternal origin, are abundant. So now if we look at our process 4/5, its intensity, it has very strong overlap with these regions. Now, of course, there are more regions where this process has high intensity. And we find many more regions, again, it's still localized. It's not a very large fraction of the genome, but we find a whole bunch of other places where we see density of maternal clusters, de novo maternal clusters, correlating with these regions we pick up from unsupervised analysis of polymorphism data. They frequently colocalize with fragile genes. Another feature of maternal inheritance is that if we look at maternal age, then in these regions, difference between older parents and younger parents is striking, but only for maternal mutations, and there is no difference for mutations in paternal origins. And this is not only C2G. C2G is a big part of the story, but if you exclude them, other mutations in the same regions behave the same way. Now I have 59 seconds to go, so this is my last slide before acknowledgments. What is interesting here is that the process is highly correlated with the direction of transcriptions. Again, it's trend dependent. And this is what tells us that there's probably more to the story than repair of double strand breaks. So we tried to come up with a story that would incorporate repair of double strand breaks and bulk elisions or any process asymmetric with respect to direction of transcription. We couldn't, but we think that there is a lot of DNA damage, potentially bulk elisions, maybe something else going on, maybe transcription-associated mutagenesis, but something related to direction of genes in this regions. Okay, so bottom line is, we can take completely unsupervised model, throw into polymorphism data,
learned processes and then looking through epigenomic features, looking at DNA symmetry, and in one instance doing follow-up experiments, we can learn what's happening. And if we learn it right, there are 9 processes driving germline mutagenesis at the scale of 30 kb. So again, Vladimir Rovovo-Siplarsky and Ruslan is our collaborator in Peter Karchenko lab. They contributed mostly to this analysis. I'm grateful to TopMed Population Genetics Working Group, which is called Population Working Group, so I expanded it beyond genetics in this slide. And collaborators, of course, all of our lab and how seriously we think about the projects. And if it's allowed in Collège de France, I will end on blunt advertising. Thank you.